Okay, this afternoon we're having Paul Higgs from the University of Manchester with the Department of Biological Sciences. Department of Biological Sciences talking about memes and the evolution of imitation.
Okay, so I have to say that this is very much a sideline and it's something I don't know very much about, but I just think it's a fun subject. It's an unofficial talk, this one is. A meme is a word which was invented by Richard Dawkins in the book called Selfish Gene, which is about 20 to 25 years old. And it's now in the Oxford Dictionary, and it's called, so the definition of a meme then is any element of culture that can be passed on by imitation. So a meme could be anything, right? It could be something very trivial, like a catchy tune that somebody whistles and then you copy it and you go around whistling the same tune. Or it could be something like hairstyles or styles of buildings and clothes. It could be something, you know, deep and meaningful like a religious faith or a principle of democracy or sex equality. Or it could be something very concrete and useful like a way of making a new stone axe or a way of planting your crops or a technique of doing something which is useful. Okay? It could be even something that's harmful, so it could be a habit of smoking or something like that. So I mean, we smoke because we see other people smoking and we think it's a good idea, even though in principle we know it's bad for us. So then a meme is anything that you can learn from somebody else by copying. And Richard Dawkins was interested in the idea of a meme as being a replicator. So in the Selfish Gene book, he spent a long time talking about genes as replicators. Genes are things which can copy themselves using bodies as means of doing the copying. In other words, the organism is the vehicle for the copying of the genes. That's his Selfish Gene argument. And the meme argument works in the same way, and it says that brains are the vehicle for the copying of memes. So Richard Dawkins is interested in sort of interaction between science and religion, and he talks about, he's rather anti-religion, okay, and he talks about religion as being viruses of the mind. So the idea is that religion is a group of ideas which is very good at getting itself copied from one person to another, and it has built-in instructions which say that if you believe it, then you think it's very important, so you want to go and tell everybody else about it, and that's why you spread it. Okay? So certain memes have built in with them the force that makes them be copied easily to other people. Okay? So his original idea was that the memes are replicators and they use brains as a means of being copied. Okay? So we're sort of controlled by our memes almost. Yeah? Now, so I read that a long time ago and what got me interested in it recently was a book by Susan Blackmore called The Meme Machine. So this is, I think, last year. And she really talks about a lot of important things in the context of memes. And she talks about the evolution of the big brain. Why do humans have big brains? And that's what most of my talks can be about. She also talks about the evolution of language. Because language is obviously a means of communication and it's the principal way in which we spread memes from one person to another. So if you believe in memes, then that's why we have... And the reason we have language is because language is a good means of spreading memes. Yeah? Okay? She also talks about religions and altruism and towards the end she goes a little bit off the rails then, because she goes about consciousness and the self and what does it mean to be... What is conscious, and she argues that we are really just the sum of our means. But anyway, there's an awful lot of good ideas in this book, and the particular one that caught my imagination was why do we have big brains? Okay, and that's what the main talk is going to be about. For some reason on the bottom of the article, memes evolve for their own benefit. Okay, so if we just continue with this idea of memes of being replicators, and they're replicating themselves, and they don't necessarily have much. Well, we don't bother at all what their effect is on the people that are carrying them about. Okay, a mean just needs to be able to copy itself. If it's disadvantageous to the person to know the mean, then it doesn't actually matter as long as that mean gets transmitted. Okay. So this then raises the question of how much can memes evolve independently of genes? Because if a meme says jump off the cliff, okay, if you pick up the idea that it's a good idea to jump off the cliff, then you're not going to be around very long, and therefore you're not going to spread that meme very well. Okay? So a meme is extremely disadvantageous to the biological fitness of the person who has it. Is also not going to survive very long. Okay? But a meme which is to some degree disadvantageous, let's say smoking, can nevertheless survive because if in the short term people pass on the idea of smoking to everybody else, then it doesn't matter that smoking is disadvantageous to the fitness of the organs. Okay? So there is at least some degree of decoupling between the evolution of the memes and what's good for the spread of the memes and what's good for the organism itself.
Okay. Just like any other parasite. Parasite kills the host.
Yes. So there's this thing called the leash principle, which comes up in quite a few places. So the leash principle is the idea that genes keep memes on a leash. Okay? And that memes have a certain amount of freedom to go their own way, but if they're extremely disadvantageous to the fitness of the organism, then they can't. So memes may be pulling their own way, but they're on a leash like a dog, and the genes are like a person holding the leash. Okay? Because if the memes try to go somewhere which is too disadvantageous from what the fitness of the genes would like, then they can't. Okay? Now, so that's what people say mean when they say the leash principle. It may or may not be true, okay? Because the point is that the evolution of the memes can go on a very much faster scale than the evolution of the genes. Okay? So if a meme manages to get it spread around via the World Wide Web and television and all these things, it doesn't matter very much that it may cause people to die in 10 years. Okay? So the time scales between the meme evolution and the gene evolution in present-day humans are very different because we're so good at copying memes. Okay? We've reached the stage where we're so good at learning from each other and copying each other that memes can spread very much faster than the lifetime of a person, and therefore they may this principle may not be true. Okay.
One meme conveys a great benefit to biological organisms. Might quite benefit the meme, but otherwise in its absence, the absence of that would cushion it.
There's going to be interactions between memes, because if you know A and B and then you know C, that may be helpful, but it may not be helpful to know C before you know A.
I'm thinking in terms of like Catholicism. That's a meme. Exposition is about what is called reproductive freedom and things like that. And that is something that then actually enhances its fitness.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's in that. Okay. it enhances the, does it enhance the fitness of the organism? You
can argue about that, right?
The number of upstream. Maybe they have more upstream.
They have more upstream, that's fitness.
Okay. So there's a whole lot of interesting questions raised by the idea of meaning, but I want to concentrate now on one relatively concrete one, which is the evolution of the brain cells. Yeah? So,
human beings have large brains in comparison to other animals and in comparison to their body size. So there's this famous graph that you see in biology textbooks of brain size and body size for different organisms. And basically, as the body size increases, the brain size increases, but then humans are right up the top of the scale, so that even though we have relatively large bodies in comparison to most mammals, say, we have very much larger brains. So the proportion of the body size which is brain in humans is very large. Okay? And we also know that brains are costly because they are metabolically costly, takes a lot of energy to run them, and also because in humans at the moment, babies have such big heads because of their large brains, but there's a significant risk of death or injury in childbirth as well, which is a very unusual situation because most doesn't happen in most animals. Okay? So there are significant costs to having a large brain, and that means there must be significant benefits to having a brain to overcome those costs. And you know, we can sit here and think, well, we wouldn't like to be managing without a brain. So it may sort of seem obvious to us that there are benefits to having a brain. But what we want to explain is, how did we get from a primitive human with an animal-sized brain to a modern-day human? Okay. And so the argument by Susan Blackmore, which is in the Mean Machine book, is basically this. I mean, she's considering ancestral humans with low cognitive ability. They're a little bit better, but humans are still noticeably. Yeah. And they can do it for things like Australopithecus and whatever it is. They can do it for fossil humanoid, you know. And yeah. I mean, I haven't got the graph, but I mean, it's a relatively significant jump in humans as opposed to animals. So.
I thought, from what I read from the fossil humanoids, brain size has not changed very much. Is that right? I thought that was what I read.
Depends when.
Depends on when. From perhaps from like the Robustus.
Okay. I'm not an expert on the fossil records, right? And exactly when these things happen. But we're talking about the evolution of humans over a period, relatively recent period, yeah? Maybe 10 million years or something like this, right? And certainly the earliest things which are recognized as human fossils are very much, especially they're very much smaller and they're very much different in proportion in terms of brain size and such. So the argument goes that if we consider primitive humans with rather low brain size and rather poor ability to imitate humans, then there would have been a selective advantage to those who had a better imitative ability. Because if, and now again, somebody discovers something useful, and if you can copy and do that useful thing, then you gain an advantage. So genes for imitative ability increase in frequency, and therefore the whole imitative ability of the population increases. And then the next point is that imitation is actually a difficult task which requires a large brain. Right. And he uses this because most animals can't imitate very well. So if you look at
birds.
Well, so some birds can imitate some things, but so you know, some species can imitate some particular things, like bird songs or sounds. But there's no other organism which has a general imitative ability equivalent to humans. Okay. So there's a lot of studies on things like chimpanzees and what can we do, right? And to some extent,
chimpanzees and dogs and birds and things can imitate certain things. But there's still a big gap.
So the question is then whether parrots have very large brain to body size ratio, this ratio, compared to other birds. Do you know?
I don't know. I suspect probably they do. But I suspect that is known, but I'm afraid I don't know.
So this is assuming, this is a basic assumption that most things nature such as protection, like that's called mate.
I guess so. All known. So there's several ways you can know things, right? You can either have it in there, or you can learn it yourself by trial and error, or you can copy it.
But there is another way which actually requires even more brain than imitating. If you invent, it's called inventing.
Yes, so that's like, well, okay, so inventing is a bit like trial and error. Well, so you have an idea.
No, it's a bit like inventing, yeah. And this is what we are best at, we think at least. So.
I'm actually going to, so at the end of this talk, I'm going to show imitation is more important than invention. So that's coming up.
Yeah. Let's let Paul proceed a bit.
Right. Okay, so this is a verbal argument in her book, which I quite like, and I wanted a mathematical model to show that it worked. So that's
in the right place.
So there's several slides coming up to explain how the model works. I want to say that each individual has both a biological fitness and a cultural fitness. And a biological fitness is basically the same as we normally talk about fitness in population genetics. The biological fitness is proportional to the number of offspring of that individual. So W is the fitness of an individual, W bar is the mean fitness of the population, and the expected number of offspring is basically W or W bar. Now, a cultural parent is an individual from which we learn means, but is not directly related to us. Okay? So it's somebody from whom we learn things other than our parents. And I'm going to define something called a cultural fitness, which is the expected number of cultural offspring, okay? So in other words, you're now cultural offspring of me, because you're learning things from me. So the idea is that the different individuals have different abilities to pass on things, okay? They have different status. So they could be the headman of a village, or they could be a teacher, or they could be a religious leader, or something like that. So people like that have a cultural fitness which is higher than somebody who has low rank or no ability to pass on their needs. Okay? So now I want genes to be inherited vertically from biological parents, as in normal genetics. And we want memes to be inherited, well, they can be inherited vertically from the parents, because we pick up things from our parents. Obliquely, means they come from other individuals in the parent generation, but not our parents. Okay, so they come from the cultural parents. Okay, and they can also be inherited horizontally. So horizontally is from one person in the same generation to another person. Okay, and in the first version of the model, there's no horizontal and oblique are very similar as far as model goes. And in the first version, horizontal is excluded. Okay? So basically the point is genes are only inherited from the biological parents, but memes are inherited from other people as well as the biological parents. So now we want to know, what is the effect on the fitness of an individual of having memes? So let's start with a naive individual who knows nothing. So this is the basic animal human who knows nothing, and he's got to define to have a fitness one and a cultural fitness one. Okay? Now, each meme that is learned
has an effect on the fitness of 1 plus little s. And little s is a random variable. So s can be positive or negative. Then there's also the mean has an effect on the cultural fitness of the individual who has it, which is 1 plus little c, which also has some variance and which can be positive or negative. So I've deliberately set this up to be symmetrical. So there's the same chance that the average of s and the average of c are zero. Okay? And I've set it up like that. So that on average, each mean has no effect. What I wanted to avoid is saying the fact that every mean is advantageous. If I make every mean advantageous, then it's obviously a benefit to learn them. So the fact that selection drives imitation is not surprising. What I'm going to show is that selection drives imitation even if the average fitness of a mean is no effect in this case. Even if means are equally likely to be positive and negative. So the fitness of an individual then is the product over the means that it knows of the 1 plus s factors of all the means that it knows. Okay, and the same for the cultural fitness. And I'm supposing that the s and the c for each mean are independent of one another, so that sometimes a mean has both a positive effect on culture and on biological fitness. Sometimes it can be positive for one and negative for the other, and sometimes it can be negative.
Is it crucial that you choose multiplicative rather than additive? For a small s, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
For a small s, so are you assuming s and c are small?
Yeah. I'm assuming s is small in the simulation.
Sigma is small compared to 1.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's 0.2 in the simulations I'm going to show you. So, yeah.
But if you're lots of means, it may matter.
I don't think it matters much. I think it could be either way. This is a sort of this is a zero assumption. It's just saying means don't depend on one another. Yeah. So if a mean gives you a 20% advantage, it gives you a 20% advantage whether or not you know anything else. That seems to be the zero approximation. Yeah. Okay. So now we want to know how easy is it for so, little l is going to be the imitative ability of an individual. And I'm going to assume l is inherited genetically via the simplest possible genetic model we can think of, which is a one-like distinct. So, you have two genes controlling your learning ability, L1 and L2, and the actual learning ability is the average of those. That's the way learning is inherited. Of course, in reality, it's many more genes, and if we wanted to make the model more complicated, we could have something like a quantitative trait controlled by many genes. But for the moment, it's just one. So how does it work? Here we have, these are the individuals in the parental generation of time t. These are the new offspring generation of time t plus 1. And the population size is n, and it's constant. So now, we have two biological parents, and those are the red ones. So the red ones down there are selected from the parental generation with probability proportional to the biological fitness of the parents. Okay? And both genes and memes are transmitted from the parents to the offspring. And then we have k cultural parents. So k can be any number, k is a parameter, but it's going to be 2 in the simulation. So the K cultural parents are chosen from the parental generation with probability proportional to their Vs. Okay? And they transmit memes only. Yeah? And each individual in the offspring generation has 2 red ones and K pink ones, which are selected independently from the previous generation. Yeah? So now I want to know, well, copying genes. So genes are copied by normal Mendelian inheritance. So I take one of the L genes at random from each of the parents. Then there's a mutation probability. So there's a small probability that the L mutates, the allele for L mutates. And if a mutation occurs, then the new value is the old value plus a small delta L, which is a mean zero and a standard deviation.
Okay, so that's normal inheritance of a single gene. Now we want to inherit the means then.
So it's diploid for genes, but haploid.
You have as many, you are lucky, so it's diploid for genes. You always have exactly two genes. And you have as many means as you want to. Because the number of means is not fixed. But you have k is the number of people from which you have the opportunity to learn means. Yeah. Okay. So little l was the actual learning ability. And now I want to I'm using little l to represent brain size in effect. Okay? I'm saying that the bigger the brain is, the more L you've got, okay? Now, but I want to actually distinguish between little L, which is like the learning ability, and big L, which is the probability of learning any one single mean. And I want it to have this shape, okay? So I want to say that if I have no brain at all, I can't learn anything. So L of naught, big L of naught is naught, right? If I have an enormous brain, I can learn anything I want to. So big L of infinity is 1, right? And so I wanted to have this shape, okay? And this is the form that I use, which has that shape, okay? And I can actually derive that by a subsidiary argument, if you want to, okay? Which it goes like this. Suppose there are n occasions to learn a mean. In other words, you see your parent doing something, and you observe them doing it n times, and n is a big number, okay? And the probability of you correctly learning or correctly copying it on any one occasion, let's suppose it's some number a times your learning ability, and a is going to be a very small number. So the point is, the probability of you correctly copying it on any one occasion that you see it demonstrated is a l, where, in other words, it's a small number proportional to your learning ability. So the probability of not learning it on n occasions is 1 minus al to the n. The probability of learning it at least once, in other words, if you've learned it correctly once, you've learned it, right? So the probability of learning it is 1 minus that, which is 1 minus e to the l. Well, it's 1 minus e to the nal, which is if you take that up into the exponential. And I'm allowed to set na equals 1. I'm allowed to set na equals 1 with no loss of generality, because all I've done by doing that is to set the scale of what I mean by L, okay? Yeah? So I don't need those parameters, okay? So this, if you like, all this bit down here is just a way of justifying that form for the learning probability, which I knew it must have that form in the first place, yeah? From common sense, I think. So
L has a floor of 0, L can't go below 0.
Little L. No. Because that's no brain. So, you can't have a negative brain. Right. So, okay, so how do we copy memes? What we just have to explain now is how do you copy memes? Each individual in the parent generation has a list of memes that it knows. Each new individual looks at that list of memes, and with a probability big L, it learns each meme that the parent knows. So you go through parent number one and learn each mean with that probability. Then you go through parent number two. If you haven't already learned it from the first parent, you learn it with that probability. Okay? So if you can't learn the same mean twice, you can have more than one attempt at learning a mean. So if both parents and your cultural parents, if everybody in the population knows this, then you see it demonstrated more often. So you have more than one chance of learning. But if you've learned it, you can only learn it.
Are there any contradictory means to what if it's not possible to
In this version, there are. We begin a version where there are categories of means, in fact. So that there are maybe many versions of the same thing, different ways of doing the same thing, in other words, and you have to decide between one or another. So we did that as well in the main language. So in what I'm going to show you here, which is the first version, each meme is something different. So in principle, you can learn any number of different memes. You can't learn the same thing. Okay.
There was no brains, there was no limit to the number of things you could learn, okay? Or the number of things you could remember. The limiting factor was actually learning in the first place, rather than remembering.
But this idea of contradictory means may be very relevant to human society, because you may really have different influences that are contradictory.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's your model that makes coming up. I agree.
Yeah.
But so the issue I'm focusing on here is how did we get to a state that memes in the first place? Okay? So clearly at the moment we all know lots of memes, and memes are very important. But at some point in the past we didn't have this. And we want to understand how we got to that situation. So as we were developing from primitive humans, we presumably knew very few memes. So we certainly didn't know 10 versions of the same thing. Yeah. So whether or not there's 10 versions conflicting of the same thing is probably relevant now, but probably wasn't relevant for the community. That's what I'm saying. And when cultures have got established already, you've really got to.
So,
sorry, the actual influence. I didn't hear what you said, but if it was a joke, I might not have asked.
I think that part of the brain should go into evaluating borderline, you know, what is the influence of the particular meme on a one's performance.
Yes.
And then this would make much more.
You made two good points actually, which I need to think about. Right? Well, the first one was invention, that I nearly forgot to mention. You obviously, in the model, you have to have a probability of inventing a new meme. In this version, then, there is some small probability that each individual, each generation, invents a new meme. And that's a new random meme with a random S and a random C value. Okay? Independently of brain size. And so at the moment, this in the first version of the model, this can't evolve. This is a fixed parameter. But in the later version, this will evolve. And that's what I said earlier on. If this evolves, let's just do that later on, okay? In the first version, I keep this as a fixed small parameter, but I allow the imitative ability to evolve. Right? Then the second thing, which I think you were just saying, is that when you see something demonstrated, you have some opinion on whether it's useful or not, right? So you're only going to learn things you think are useful, right? So there has to be some ability to discriminate between what you think is a useful meme and what you think is a non-useful. And that discriminative ability can evolve as well. And we put that in again in another version, which we may get to towards the end. But the conclusion of all this is that the imitation is more important than either the invention or the discrimination. And hopefully we'll explain why that is in a minute. That would be, I agree that would be an interesting special case to look at. So do you take more numbers of your parents or less numbers of your parents? For example, should you could think of that as a meme, because there's a meme which says, obey your parents, and there's a meme which says, do exactly what they tell you not to do. Yeah? And you could think of which of those actually does better. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But that, I don't know the answer.
Okay. But in terms of this evaluation, you have the assumption that the average usefulness of the meme is zero. This is probably quite crucial because the spread starts being important when the average is zero. If the average is not zero, then you have a very strong exponentiation of the mean.
If you can even make the mean slightly negative.
Positive.
If you make negative. If you make more than half of them unfavorable.
No, but if you make them favorable, then this exponentiation due to the fact that the average is positive is going to be more important quite soon than the width. Let me put it this way.
So I don't want to make the average positive, because then it's obvious if every mean is advantageous on average, then you want to learn as many as possible.
No, what I was saying, once you have the discrimination, then you can discard a lot of the negative ones, and then automatically you have a positive mean.
Right.
Actually, so, this is just one thing, is that your model has a kind of a building mechanism which prevents a person from learning too many bad means. It's a little bit here in your rules, but it's there. The reason why is that if each mean confers a CM in terms of it confers you an extra fitness 1 plus CM, right? And then you multiply all those 1 plus CMs, many, many of them. And if you multiply, it's like a multiplicative random process. And the multiplicative random process will have an average smaller than your CM. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that if you learn too many means, your fitness will typically use the rest in your model. Just because of this multiplication rule.
Let me translate it in the following. As you have more means, your Gaussian gets wider. Now, at a certain stage, the width of the Gaussian would touch the zero. Now, compared to the other width will touch two. So you have with equal probability the probability of just doubling your capabilities and of bringing them to zero. So in terms of the factors, having equally spread Gaussian is disadvantageous. This is what he's trying to say, and I think it's right. It is related a little bit to what I said.
I'd like to explain what happens with this version, and then we can argue whether modification would make any difference. I think it makes rather little difference what the distribution of the thicknesses is. What I would like to show is that imitation is favored under fairly restrictive conditions, okay? Fairly hard conditions. If I make all means positive and I show those imitations are favored, then I haven't shown very much. If I make half of them negative and half of them positive, then I've shown more than that, right? If I were to put in a discrimination rule that says I only learn the good ones, then again, it's obvious that imitation would be favored. But if I, in this model then, to begin with, they're learning randomly any old thing, and it's equally likely to be positive or negative. So if I can show that imitation is favored in this case, follows in a more robust way as it's played in a lot of other cases as well. Okay. So,
I'm totally supportive of this. All I'm saying is that you make it even harder for people to learn, and if it's still favorable in your case, then.
Because I thought I made it. Let's think about that afterwards, right? So now we get to this is a simulation, right? And I like to maintain an element of surprise here. So some of you have seen it. Some of you have seen it before. Okay. So I've got three graphs here from one simulation. This is the learning ability. So this is the average of the little L in the population. Average over all members of the population as a function of time going along this.
How many individuals?
Oh, 2,000 or something. Whatever can be in number of
thousands.
Right. This is the number of means known. This is the average number of means known per individual. And it starts off at 10 to the minus 1 because the invention probability is 0.1, right? So the point. So what I'm saying is there's a probability of 0.1 that each individual invents a new mean each generation. And to begin with, the average number of means known in the population is 0.1, because the only means that anybody knows are ones that they've invented for themselves. Okay? It's time, right? And then this is the mean fitness of the population. So 10 to the naught here is one, because they start off having no means and the thickness is one for people with no means, right? So now tell me what's going to happen in this simulation.
Brains will get bigger.
Brains will get bigger. Why do they get bigger? So they're going up a bit, right? So the learning ability is going up. You know, there's a trend upwards here, a slow trend over time for the due to mutations of the learning genes, because the average learning ability is going up. The number of means known is going up very, very well. A little bit, but you can hardly tell, okay? It's still true that most means known in the population here are ones that they've invented themselves. And the mean thickness, you can hardly tell that that's gone up, okay? But because means are equally likely to be positive and negative. You only know one mean with a probability 0.1, so that the effect of the thickness is very small, you can hardly see.
This is with K equals 2.
It's with K equals 2.
If you increase K, does that make a big difference?
It will make a difference. So then that's why I like to maintain the elements of surprise, because the point is that suddenly you reach a point where the whole thing takes off, right? And it goes up by orders of magnitude, right? So the number of means known per individual suddenly rockets up by orders of magnitude, and we have to stop the simulation. So in the model, this version of the model, there's no limit to the size of the memory. So once you stop to be able to copy things, you can copy as many as you want. So I have to stop the simulation after that point because the memory of the computer will tell.
So is this dangerous to teach chimpanzees to speak?
Take over the world, it can occur. And the mean thickness goes up by orders of magnitude, okay? And the learning ability goes up, I mean, not by orders of magnitude because it's constrained by the genetics, but the point is it goes up rapidly. So I'm going to define a point called the mimetic transition, which is where the number of means on average is one per person. So before the mimetic transition, you learn on average, you know, less than one mean, and most of the means that you know come from personal invention rather than by copy. Beyond the mimetic transition, you know very many means, and most of them have come through imitation of other people rather than inventing yourself. So why does this transition happen? It happens because means can spread like an epidemic. If you think of the learning ability of an individual, if you think about how many individuals, you know me, how many means do you pass that on to, right? And that's rather like spreading an infectious disease. So there's a thing called R0 in epidemiology, which is the number of infected people you create as a result of being infected yourself, okay? And the same thing goes for means as well. You can say, what is the average number of other people who learn a mean from you? If that number is larger than one, then the thing multiplies exponentially. If it's less than one, then it dies out exponentially. So when you're down here, each new mean that's invented only lasts for one or two generations because it dies out. Whereas once you're past that point, each mean gets copied exponentially and it lasts for a long time in the population. So I want to consider the spread of a single mean.
So for the theory purposes, let's just consider one mean with a W and a V like that. And let's suppose that everybody in the population has the same L value. XB is the frequency of the mean before selection. So it's the fraction of the population that knows that mean, for the word. XA is the frequency of the mean in the biological parents. Now, so remember, there's selection acting on the biological parents because the mean affects the thickness of the parent. So the frequency in the biological parents is actually this. Mm-hmm. And if let's talk about formula. If S is positive, the mean has a positive effect on the biological thickness. That means that the frequency of the mean in the biological parents is larger than the average frequency in the population. Okay? But that's the frequency among biological parents. The same argument works for the frequency among the cultural parents. So now what I want to say,
the probability of learning the mean from A, from one biological parent, is the probability that the biological parent knows the mean times your learning ability. Right? And for the cultural parent, it's this. So now I want to know the probability that you learn the mean from at least one of your parents. And it's one minus the probability that you don't learn it from any of them. So that's this thing. So this is the rule for transmission of the means. It tells you the frequency of the means at the next generation t plus 1 in terms of what they were time t. And this is where k comes in. Because the bigger k is, the easier it is to learn. Okay? So if we make k bigger, then it means the transition happens sooner, because you need a smaller learning ability in order to go past the threshold. Yeah. So what I want to do is from there is to so this is the frequency of time t plus 1 as a function of the frequency of time t. If the learning ability is low, it does that, and the fixed point is at 0, in other words, the mean dies out. If the learning ability is high, then there's a fixed point appearing, and you go towards that point. So the mean multiplies exponentially once that red curve goes above the green line. And the condition for that is this. So if this is true, then the mean spreads. So it's easier to spread if k is large. It's easier to spread if the learning ability is large. It's easier to spread if there's a positive effect on the fitness, either the S or the C is positive. But if S and C are negative, you can still spread if the other factors are sufficiently large. So you can have a mean which is both negative S and negative C, which can still spread by this rule.
That's a little surprising, isn't it? If they both have negative effect, you can still spread. But in this version of the model, L is, everybody has the same L, right? So you don't have any chance of being smarter than your parents. I mean, the next generation.
Okay, so I'm just doing it that way because it's easier for the math. Right?
Right.
So in the simulation, L is evolving. You
right,
to that would
be evolving. But here, L is not evolving in brain size. Little L.
What I want to do is I want to know how big does L has to be before the mean can spread. That's my goal of this.
Right.
I want to explain why there is a threshold. Yes?
Right.
So basically what happens is, there is a threshold value of L above which means can spread. And L is very gradually selected upwards until you reach the threshold point.
Right.
Then suddenly everything takes off and the selection on L suddenly becomes very large.
But I'm saying the assumption of uniform L is perhaps, it works against you. Because if the bell curve, then of course there's some very smart individual who
This is a simple way of showing that there's a threshold and why to expect there to be a transition. If you knew what the distribution of the L's was, you could put that in, but I don't know how to calculate the distribution of the L.
Yeah. So what happens is you'll get something with the highest S, the highest C, will take off first.
Mm-hmm.
And so the L threshold is actually the L threshold corresponding to the most favorable mean in the population.
Yeah. But in fact, they don't differ from one. I mean, what I calculated here was what happens if S and C, let's take an average mean with zero S and C, right? Then you've got an easy rule there. It says that when L is bigger than 1 plus 2k, which is a quarter in my simulation, then, okay. So when big L is bigger than a quarter, it means that little l, that came from the exponential function, is bigger than 0.288, right? And if we go back to the simulation, that's more or less what was happening. So, I mean, as an order of magnitude, when this is getting to about 0.2, we're getting the transition. And it happens that with L lower than the number I just calculated, precisely because the best means spread first.
But I'm sorry, independently on the learning ability, suppose that you have a distribution of the quality of the means, which is perfect. And now let everybody inherit the means of the parents. No learning, just inheriting by father, by being born to that same thing. And let the probability of offspring being proportional to 1 plus S. You will eventually have that the guys with the largest S. Will take exponentially. Each family will increase exponentially, of course, which has positive S, mm-hmm. except that the one with the largest S will explode with a larger exponential than anybody else. Mm-hmm. And it will take over.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in other words, if means were only spread vertically, yeah. it would still happen.
Yes.
Right. The fact that they
you get exactly the same graph, an exponential, which you
and it will take longer to occur.
Yeah.
It will take long. I mean, it will take longer to occur. I mean, if I can put k equals naught there, and it will still happen eventually.
I mean, means go Lamarckian rather than Darwinian, and so this k term here is exactly the Lamarckian evolution compared with the other term, which is the Darwinian evolution, and if both are operative. The mark is going to be more important than
that. What I would think is also that if you do allow crossing between the families, then in fact the highest one would be the advantage. You see, as it is, you have the 1 plus the largest S.
So that the highest one is spreading the means to the other ones.
He has the chance to go exponentially with the highest exponential. Once you allow mixing, it will only decrease exponentially.
If someone put in the genomic schools, where k is large, this part of the population will be
But here's the even here with the zero.
No, but that's the point. You see, if you do mix the different theories. Some of them are negative. In fact, this was his strong point. Look, I think negative that. Now, this is what I'm saying. This learning stuff is only making progress. If you just let the family with the largest S develop unbothered, this will go with the highest possible exponential in the system.
It will take longer because we will spread
slower.
We calculated the spread probability, the probability of spread of a mean, right? And the probability of spread goes down when k goes down. So I can put k equals naught, in which case it's only vertically inherited. The same will happen, but it will take longer to happen. That's the
I think it's a question of limits. Between m going to infinity, how many individuals you have versus this value of k, it's a non-trivial.
This was, I put this on because it's
because if the coefficient in growth of the largest exponential, if you take, it's essentially 1 over n, where n is the number of families. So it is true that if you take the number of families to infinity, the coefficient in growth of the e to the power s, it's very small, and it will take a very large time for him to win.
I was assuming a large population. That was a large population rule, because I was a deterministic rule that said, what's the frequency of the mean if time t equals 1 as a function of time t? So that was a large population.
It appears implicitly because you do spread the probability of appearance of all the representatives. So there is a normalization in this. Each guy has a certain normalization in this. The largest exponential is only multiplied by a unit. That is true, but it would eventually take over.
Okay. This was to show the fact of changing the population size. So this was a simulation with n is 100, and this was n is 2,000, and all the other parameters are the same. So the frequencies of the means are the same, the probabilities of inventing are the same. And I show this because, again, we have a small population and we have a lot of drift up and down here, okay? So in a small population, drifting frequencies can dominate the selective advantage for the learning gene, okay? But that happens for a while, and then once you reach the threshold, you zoom up, okay? So once you've gotten to the threshold, the size of the selection on the learning gene is very large. Because once you've got to the level where you can learn lots of memes, it's very advantageous to learn even more. Yeah? The number of extra memes that you learn by going up from L to L plus DL is proportional to L. That's the point. So the bigger your L, the larger the selective advantage for increasing by yet another DL. Okay? So when you're down here, with a small population, the selective advantage is small compared to the drift. And so it takes a long time until you get to a point here. But once you've got to that point, selection takes time. And in the large population, you've got much less drift, and you've got a steady trend upwards towards the transition point. The other point about this is these are independent rooms with the same parameters but different random numbers, and the time it takes to get there is it fluctuates a lot, but it always happens.
So the only advantage to learning ability is if the average S of the means in the population is positive.
So, the average S is not positive. Oh.
In the integrated population.
Okay, I want to explain the reason I think learning is collaborative. Right? I want to look at, this is the thickness of the individuals, in one. And here are the individuals who have no learning ability. They have no learning ability, therefore they know no means, therefore they're thickness. Now, this is the distribution of thicknesses of the individuals who have some learning ability. Okay? So they pick up memes, but in this case there's no discrimination. They pick up good and bad memes at random. So they have a distribution of thicknesses. They have some bad ones and some good ones. Okay? But the point is that at least some of the individuals out here have both high learning ability and happen to pick up good memes. Those are the ones that do well. So these are the ones that are having lots of velocity. So that's why it's an advantage to increase the learning. Okay? Now, the point is, these ones, they happen to learn good memes. So therefore they have higher thickness. Therefore they have lots of offspring. And their offspring learn the good memes, okay? Because there's a correlation between the offspring and the parents. So, yeah, I think I've said it already.
You're saying that if you modify your rule so that you get the mean only from the public, then you should be wrong.
Yeah.
You're part of that.
No, I think it will take longer, but it will still happen. I can't swear to that, but I'm fairly sure it will still happen. Because in fact, that's included in my formula, isn't it? I mean, I can put the two, if you remember the formula. This two was the two because it was two biological parents, but I could set that two to be zero, and this would still...
But that tells you the takeoff of the mean, so it doesn't tell you the takeoff of the L.
No, but in this model, L doesn't involve dispersion, right?
This is not a model. This is a theory to try and explain why L, exactly. Why L takes off in the
question. But this is
why
means take off, not why L takes off. So this is under condition for a neutral for a mean.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is the condition for a neutral for a mean spread.
Why? I believe, but I can't swear, but I believe if you only inherited means from the cultural parents, you would still have the same transition. And it would take longer to occur than it was missing. The same thing would happen, I believe.
The crucial part is that L is comparable. Learning means.
Yes. L is inherited. Right. So it doesn't really matter who you're learning your means from. If you're inheriting a higher value of L, you're more likely to pick up the good means that are around. There's an additional advantage, as I was saying here, the fact that you're. If your parents have high L, they probably have good means as well, and you have a you're quite likely to pick up your parents' food needs, so that's a helping factor. Yeah. That's why it will take longer if you didn't learn. So in your case, if you didn't learn what your parents said, it would actually take longer.
But
this diagram is why I argue that it does. Yeah. And in fact,
I would argue that. I don't think it's that at all. Because if you imagine I have a population with a distribution of W values corresponding to large brains, and they ask what is the increase in the brain size in the next generation, then it averages out. I think there's another mechanism, which is the fact that disadvantageous genes tend to die out faster than advantageous genes, and so the distribution of W shifts to the right, the average value shifts to the right, so that you're left
with... Well, the average value, I mean, it certainly does, because the mean fitness, that was this, right? So the top graph is the mean fitness of the population, which goes up by orders of magnitude. So the point is, the average fitness of the means that are actually known by the individuals is definitely positive. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But new means are random.
Right.
Yeah. And also, you can set, if the distribution of new means has a negative mean, right? If I make the average mean slightly negative, it still happens. Because the point is, there are some which came positive. So if you make the average slightly negative, it still runs away.
Well, in fact, this brings me to the following example or question. If you have infinite learning capability, suppose that all the representatives know all the means, then each of them will have as their fitness, the one which has average one. And there will be no exponent creation. What I'm trying to say is that, in fact, again, I'm giving an extreme example in order to make the point that I think that, in fact, it's better not to have learning.
Not to have one?
Not to have learning. To let the guys having each of them their means and to let them exponentiate according to that exponential which they inherit, and that that's the best ones win.
You want me to not have learning at all, or not have learning apart from the past?
I'm suggesting you to compare a situation in which nobody learns anything, it just inherits the essence of the main means of their parents, compared with everybody knowing all the means at least.
But that's not an allowed question to ask, because we know that we don't have inherited ability to do theoretical. We know that. What the question is, why do we learn things at all, right?
Just try k equals zero and ask what the qualitative difference is. Which you've done, presumably.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely k equals zero would mean it would still, in this model, it would mean learning things from your parents, not learning from anybody else.
Yeah.
Which is different from inheriting things.
Yeah. Now I'm saying something more, that maybe there is something which I don't understand in the formula, but naively I would say that if I have absolute learning capability, and I would know all of the means, then I would have a fitness which corresponds with having all of the means, which means the average mean as inputted in the system, which is zero.
No, because if you learn, say, a mean which takes your fitness to zero, then you read out of the
equation, and then you... Everybody learns everything. Now everybody is
everything.
But this was the exact point that we started with this discussion, with whether it's good to have absolutely largest brains possible. And I'm saying, if you have the largest brains possible in this population, which means everybody learns everything, then in fact this would be bad for the computation. Because you would be left with essentially no exponential.
What if it is out of the space of parameters for which it was designed? It was designed to be mastered with red explosion in learning community. And you try to tell us that if learning community is already high enough for that this model
I'm saying two things. One, that in fact the running to infinity is due to exponentiation of the largest breath, and that any interference with this mechanism is in fact diminishing.
But then we know that from the calculations in Hall, maybe k equals zero, but that's not true. That k equals zero is your model. And at the onset of this exponentiation is delayed.
Because even if I put k equals zero, I've still got a learning ability. The point is, in this model, to begin
right,
with,
but it's only for recurrence. It's only for recurrence.
But I think that it's but the only guys which matter, which are the guys with the highest skillness, it's good for them to learn. That's my point.
Well, I disagree with that.
Because it's the best thing to learn only from their parents.
Well, let's talk about that. But I think my point will show that's not true. So far there's been no penalty, right? We started off by saying we want to explain why brains evolve to be large, even though there's a metabolic cost to them, and there's possible cost to dangers at childbirth and so on, right? So far I didn't put that in, and what I want to do now is to add that. So I want to say, let there be a cost to the brain size, which is f, a little f, right? So what I'm thinking of now is that if 1 represents the amount of metabolic energy that you use normally with that brain, f of l is the amount of extra cost to that brain, right? And I want to say, well, therefore the fitness should be inversely proportional to that. So I'm going to suppose that there's a fitness factor proportional to brain size, which is now a decreasing function of L. So I could say that F of L was linear, so then I get that 1 plus 1 over L function there. Or I could say that, let's suppose that the cost increases exponentially, okay? In which case I get a 1 over 1 plus exponential like a sort of thing. So those are there, okay? So let me just show you a simulation with one of those exponential curves at the moment, okay? And it looks like this. So the point is now, you're going along, you get the transition, but the transition can't go rocketing off the top to infinity now. It has to stop, because sooner or later the brain size gets to the point where the threshold comes down and prevents it going anymore, okay? So that's a situation where you're limited by other factors, by the cost of the brain size from having an infinite brain, okay? But it still happens, at least in this simulation. But what I want to think about is, if you make the cost function too strong, you can stop it from happening, okay? So I want, this is a case where, basically, the cost kicks in after the transition has happened, and it doesn't prevent the transition happening, it just prevents the brain exploding in size altogether, right? But I want to think a bit more carefully about how the cost could take effect. And let's do it with linear cost, okay? So remember, the linear cost means that I have a function which is 1 plus L over L naught. So L naught would be the brain size at which this is half the fitness, okay? Now the point is, if L0 is infinity, we have what we had before, which is no cost. Okay? And it took, on average, 5,200 generations to happen. If I decrease L0, then I increase the cost, and the time to the transition goes up, until when you get to here, nothing happens.
Okay? You know nothing happens?
I'm pretty sure nothing happens. But I mean, so, if nothing happened within the longest simulation I ran, but I'm pretty sure nothing happens at all.
It depends on the population.
It depends on the
thickness of transition is a factor
in the right for conventional science.
Maybe. There's no difference. So, but the important thing, it depends on the relative size of the relative cost at the beginning, okay? Because if you look at one of these cost functions, the linear one is basically going down very slowly, okay? And look at these numbers. These numbers are quite large numbers, which means that the cost, this part, is rather small. So we're talking about this going down by a tiny amount, right? Because the relevant scale on here was about 1.2, remember, when the transition happened, okay? And these things here are very much larger than 0.2. So by the time we get to that transition point, this is hardly any cost at all, right? And so the bad news from this column is you only need a very, very tiny negative selection to prevent the transition from occurring. That's what this column says. If the cost is linear, then a very tiny amount of linear cost will stop the transition happening. And that's because this is the critical point, right? When you start off with low learning ability, you're very unlikely to pick up new means. There are very few means in the population, so the advantage of going up by a little bit is very small. So initially, the selective advantage is very low. So in the linear cost, the cost kicks in right at the beginning. And a small cost that occurs right at the beginning is sufficient to kill you off. Okay? Whereas if you have this exponential cost, now the point is here that in an exponential cost, basically what you have is this is almost flat and then you've got that. Okay? And so you've got almost no cost here. So the whole thing can get underway, but then when you get out here, by the time you get to this point on the curve, you've already learned many means. And when you learn many means, there's a great selective advantage to keeping those means and to learning more means. So what this says is that the selective advantage to having means is large enough to counteract very large costs, providing those costs occur at a relatively high rate. Okay? So one reason for being interested in this is to ask the question, why don't all animals have cultural inclusion? Okay? So what I kind of argued so far was that this is bound to happen. I said that imitation is selectively favored under very broad conditions. And so basically always happens. So then the question is, well, why doesn't every animal evolve the same system? And it must be something to do with the cost, or the point at which the cost becomes
significant. It's because it's first thing that you only have a resource.
That's a good point. Yeah. Let me just say two words, what I said earlier on. So far, I've only allowed the imitation to evolve, right? Because I thought imitation was the important thing. But then I also allowed the p-in to evolve. So the p-in was the probability of invention. And what happens then is... so you tell me what happens then. We're going to plot here as a function of time. And I started from point one, say. Let's start from point one for the p-in and point one for the learning, okay? And I want to know what happens as a function of time to the average invention probability and the average learning of the population. And then suppose now that the p-in is controlled by another locus. There's a gene that controls the p-in, so it can evolve in the same way that the other can evolve. And if I run a simulation of that, then what do you do?
Invention dies out.
Because I already said so.
No, because
what
happens is the means that you can copy from other members of the population are biased towards positive values, while an invention that you come up with yourself is not biased towards anything else besides zero.
That's true. Yes. That's another argument. I hadn't actually thought about that, but that's a good argument. What happens is you get they drift off. So to begin with, it's obviously better to increase both of them. other things being equal, it's a good idea to have both of them. Right? But what happens is, the L goes up, and when the L goes up, the P goes down. Okay? One of the reasons is because of what Richard said, I think. But then the other reason is because the cost, so I didn't say, but I have the cost here. The cost is a function of, in my explanation, cost function. And it's a function of L plus P. Okay? So basically, you can have high L or high P, you can't have both. So there's a trade-off between L and P. And what's going on is it's much better to put all your effort into L than it is into P. So we should all be plagiarizing each other's ideas rather than.
But it seems like the more reasonable model might be that P is a function of L, no? P is an increasing function of L that they're tied together. The more, the brain size evolves, you're also more dimensional.
Sure, you should have them equal, and then that should go up. But the point is that L is the most important.
But that's because the dimensions are not logical. Another twist of this might be to be average of your own invention bias that depends on L. Because the more talented are you, you will get your ideas should be a little bit better.
We didn't do that, but one thing we did do was put in this discrimination. So we had a third parameter, which was an ability to tell how we're going to read R. So the means were still distributed at random. So you generate the mean, and this is how good it really is. Then you have an estimate of how good it is. And your estimate is the real value plus or minus some uncertainty. So you have some sigma of uncertainty of estimating how good your mean is, right? So if your sigma is good, that means you have a high ability to discriminate. If your sigma is small, then your estimated value of mean is very close to the real mean, and then you say you only learn ones that you think are good. If your sigma is large, then there's some probability that you think the mean is bad, even when it is really good, and vice versa. So if the sigma is very large, it means randomly learning means, and if the sigma is small, it means you only learn good means. Right? And so this clearly, so then we have a cost, which is 1/sigma. So the cost is, so small sigma is good, right? So we want brain size to be a function of 1/sigma, yeah? So then what happens is, well, again, they both go up, and the 1/sigma is, you know, the point is, you have to, it's obviously an advantage to have an ability to tell how good your means are, but if you've got some trade-off between these things, then the best thing is the L. So L is important, right? Imitation is important in all these models. So that's the end.